This afternoon, we will be going into work session shortly on Senate Bill 5531, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Right now, since we're still waiting for a colleague from the Senate side to get a quorum, what we will do is ask to move down into the agenda to the Department of Justice budget. We'll finish that out. So if Ms. Stinson could please come forward on the Crime Victims Assistance section of the Department of Justice and continue where you left off yesterday.
Chair, this is behind the criminal justice tab after yellow the yellow sheets.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section for the Department of Justice in its Criminal Justice Division. And I'll take up where I left off yesterday. I had just begun talking with you about our crime victims compensation program in a little more detail. I think we're on page 5. The crime victims compensation program, the purpose is to ease the financial loss to victims of crimes and their families as a result of violent crime. Again, we are the payer of last resort after insurances, including Oregon Health Plan, and victims must report the crime and cooperate with prosecution. This program is funded by the criminal fine assessments and also state payments matched by federal dollars by 60%. Those state payments include punitive damage monies. Some of the budget drivers for the compensation include, of course, the rate of claims that we receive. As you can see in the second slide on page 5, we have been steadily increasing in the number of claims that we receive over the years. In 2006, nearly 6,000 claims were received, and what you don't see is the 1999 numbers, which were around 3,200. So somewhere in this next biennium, we are going to essentially increase our claim load by 100% since 1999. Some of the factors affecting those claim submissions are an increase in certain types of crime. For example, when the child abuse rate increases, then we often see an increase in the number of child abuse claims that we receive. But far more importantly, I think, and affecting the claim rate more are some of the factors that affect victims. High unemployment rates, decrease in insurance coverage, and decrease in state and community services all drive victims to seek out our program as a means to be reimbursed for crime. For example, a crime victim may have at some point be employed, have a good insurance plan, and so they may have had to make a doctor or hospital visit, have a copay of $100, and then maybe a copay of $20 or $5 or something on prescription benefits. And given their situation at the time with insurance and employment, they may not see that it's necessary to file a claim with us and go through that extra step interacting with another agency. However, that person loses their job, loses their health insurance, and is victimized. They may, well, seek out our program for help. So that's where we believe we've seen an increase in claims. And, of course, an increase in public awareness. One of the major projects that we've had running in our office for the last couple of years is the Crime Victims' Rights Compliance Project through a federal grant through the Office for Victims of Crime. And that project has involved many, many community partners, and we're really trying to get the word out about the rights that victims have in the criminal justice system, and one of those is the right to apply for crime victims compensation. So that could also be contributing to the increase in claims. As you can see there on page 6, the bottom, our compensation key performance measure number 9 deals with how quickly we process claims. Of course, customer service is very important to us, so we want to be able to get those claims in and turn them around as quickly as possible. So we strive to have 90% of the claims received processed within 90 days. And as you can see, we've been meeting that target. What you can't see in this overview of years is how in the last months we've been dipping. As the claim load rises and our staff doesn't increase, we have more and more trouble meeting that 90% mark. But we are currently meeting it. And then on page 7, this just shows you how our compensation payments have increased over the years and over the biennia. As you can see, we're on track for 07-09 to spend and pay out almost $6 million on these claims. There was a dip in 05-07, and that was due to those cost containment measures that I talked about yesterday. We had to implement some cost containment measures because of the long-term financial outlook wasn't really very good for us. So we had to make some cuts in some of the benefits that we offer to victims of crime through the compensation program. But we'll be rising again in this biennium. So moving on to the Victims Assistance Program, the second major program within our section. This program primarily consists of 6 state and federal grant programs and the Address Confidentiality Program. And I just want to run through those different types of funding here on page 7. Services that we provide through federal grants come again from the Victim of Crime Act grants, and the Federal Victim of Crime Act grants are VOCA grants, and the Federal Violence Against Women Act grants. Services through discretionary grants right now, as I said, those come from punitive damages, and we don't have enough punitive damages right now to make really extensive grants. So we have 2 small grants operating right now, a grant to Lane County Legal Aid for domestic violence services and a grant to the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. And I'll go on to talk more about the services through the criminal fines and assessment account. Those include the district and city attorney victim assistance grants and the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention grants, or CAMI grants. And then services through the general fund include the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund grants and the Address Confidentiality Program. The district and city attorney victim assistance grants are grants that were established a long time ago, 1983, to provide a statewide network of comprehensive victim services and victim assistance programs throughout the state. There are 11 statutorily required services, including notification to victims, overall advocacy to victims going through the criminal justice system, such as court accompaniment, assistance with restitution statements, and victim impact statements during the course of the process, the criminal justice process, a trial or plea. The locations of these programs are in all 36 district attorney's offices and also 5 city attorney's offices, including Salem, Beaverton, The Dalles, Eugene, and Pendleton. And this funding comes from the criminal fine assessment account. The child abuse multidisciplinary intervention grants were established a little bit later in 1993, and the purpose of those grants are to provide funds for the coordination of child abuse investigations at the local level in all 36 counties. So through the multidisciplinary teams, those groups of prosecutors, law enforcement, DHS workers, often school personnel, hospital personnel, those teams get together regularly and talk about the challenges of investigating and prosecuting and preventing child abuse in their communities. Again, there are 36 county multidisciplinary teams and 3 regional centers in Bend, Portland, and Medford, and that funding comes through the criminal fine assessment accounts also. On the top of page 9, you can see where the child abuse intervention centers exist in the state, and those centers often receive the funds through their multidisciplinary teams from the CAMI account. Now onto our general funded programs. The Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, established in 2001, a fairly new fund to us. The purpose is to provide stable, essential response services to victims of domestic violence or sexual assault and to increase victim safety. We fund program services throughout the state, and these services are supported by the general fund. These funds go to the nonprofit domestic and sexual violence service providers around the state. Our newest program, established through legislation in 2005 and operational just over a month ago, January 1st, 2007, is the Address Confidentiality Program. The purpose of this program is to provide a substitute address for victims of domestic violence, stalking, and sexual assault who, because of the crime or because of the relationship with the perpetrator are needing a substitute address. Oftentimes, a perpetrator of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking will try to locate their victim using public records. And so this allows survivors to apply to our program, be able to use the substitute address, and have that be a safe mailing address when they're interacting with public agencies. We can also serve, we can also receive legal service if they're being served with court documents through this program. This program is supported by the general fund, and we're seeking funds to continue this program in this biennium. The fiscal impact is $145,000. $145,311 in the general fund, and that funds one FTE administrative specialist. She also, in addition to forwarding the mail that she gets, she is also responsible for training applicant assistants all throughout the state. We currently, just since September, have trained 148 advocates at the local level who will be conducting comprehensive safety planning with victims who are considering using the Address Confidentiality Program. So the Address Confidentiality Program will be just one part of a comprehensive safety plan that these victims can choose to use if they would like to. So we're very proud of that accomplishment, that we have application assistance in all counties as the program is up and running in January. I want to move on to our policy option packages. I apologize for speaking so quickly, but I'm very cognizant of the time and want to make sure we get through all of this and leave time for the public hearings.
Much appreciated.
The policy option package 301 has to do with the criminal injuries compensation account. And as I mentioned before, we have had some cost containment tactics in place to maintain services through the Crime Victims Compensation Program. And we've had to eliminate some benefits, such as reimbursement for rehabilitation, travel, and family counseling. We've also had to reduce funeral expenses. We usually pay out $5,000 as a limit for funeral expenses. We've reduced that to $3,500, which can be a burden on families. But those cost containment measures have allowed us to be able to, by and large, maintain our services through the compensation program to victims of crime. So the policy option package 301 affects both the Crime Victims Compensation Program and those prosecutor-based victim assistance programs that I was just talking about. As those funds come from the criminal fines and assessment account on that kind of line item to the Crime Victims Assistance section, the funds are currently split 50% to the Crime Victims Compensation Program and 50% to those, they go back in the form of grants to those prosecutor-based victim assistance programs in all 36 counties. And those programs, as I said before, serve victims of crime individually at the local level as those victims go through the criminal justice process. Whether they're paid or volunteer staff, their services are crucial to the health and well-being and understanding of victims as they go through the criminal justice system. The fiscal impact is $2 million in other funds from the criminal fines and assessment account. And we have asked for a 0.5 FTE office specialist to do that package. Policy option package 302 affects a general funded program, the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. When this fund was established in 2001, it was around the philosophy that the state has a responsibility to provide a safety net for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And at the current level of funding, that safety net is really very compromised. An increase in the funds is necessary to even begin to provide the minimal access to services for victims throughout the state. And we fund through our office over 50 domestic and sexual violence services programs. And mainly advocates and crisis services, such as funding to go help keep their shelter open, have their hotline working 24 hours a day, to have an advocate on call, an advocate always there to talk to someone on the phone or meet them in person, file for restraining orders, meet them at the hospital for a sexual assault exam. They perform many crucial functions for victims. So this policy option package would increase the funds that go to that grant, the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. The impact is $1 million in general fund monies, and the total FTE is a 0.5 office specialist too. Policy option package number 303 affects the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention account. The number of child abuse victims in recent years has continued to rise, and dedicated funding for these services to victims of child abuse has decreased and has not met that need. So we need to increase the funding to this program in order to ensure a comprehensive and quality system for assessing and preventing and dealing with child abuse at the local level in a coordinated and comprehensive manner. The increase in these funds will increase the amount of money going to those 36 child abuse multidisciplinary teams in the counties. And one of the outcomes would be improved training to law enforcement and improved response to law enforcement, improved prosecution mechanisms, improved child abuse medical assessments at intervention centers, and ultimately an increase in access to services for victims. That fiscal impact is $1 million in other funds from the criminal fines and assessment account. Policy option package 501 is a transfer to the Department of Justice from Oregon State Police of the Federal Stop Violence Against Women Act grant funds. And ultimately, we hope that it will continue the legacy of VAWA to increase access to services to victims. We're very happy to be receiving this program and have been working under an interagency agreement with OSP for the past 3 or 4 months. As we're awaiting this formal transfer, we have a grant monitor outstationed at our office, and we are starting to slowly take over the administration of those funds, so we hope that formal transfer goes through. The fiscal impact is about $1.7 million in federal funds that would then come to DOJ instead of OSP for disbursement to prosecution, law enforcement, and victim service agencies. And that also includes a transfer of a 1.0 FTE program analyst to position. Finally, I want to talk about our two other key performance measures that are associated with domestic violence and sexual assault for our section. The first one is KPM 14, which speaks to the percentage of adults leaving a domestic violence shelter with a safety plan after a 5-day stay. And as you can see on page 15, our goal is 100%. So 100% of victims, adult victims leaving a shelter would have a safety plan after a stay of 5 days or more. Our performance measure right now is at 96%. It's actually, I just got an update from one of our partners at DHS who we share data with. She says it's closer to 97%. She was working with a program who was a little bit confused about data reporting, and that changed things a little bit. And actually, we suspect that we're closer to 100%. Our data collection is not automated through these programs, so we have some programs that are still doing the tick marks on call sheets or case files, and so we continually try to make clear how data collection is supposed to work, but we do have some challenges in that area, but we are striving for that 100% mark. And the last performance measure then, performance measure number 15, deals with the percentage of sexual assault exams conducted by a sexual assault nurse examiner in the state. And when this was established, we didn't really have a sense of what level we should strive for. Eventually, we put an 85% goal down, and as you can see, we're at 33% right now. I just want to tell you a little bit about why that's so low. The movement to train sexual assault nurse examiners or SANE nurses in Oregon really is in its infancy. In 2001, there were 6 SANEs in the state, and there was no coordinated effort for reviewing what the standards were for a SANE nurse and what their scope of practice was. So in 2001, the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force took this on as an as an item of interest and formed a medical forensic subcommittee to work on this issue. There have been 5 statewide trainings since the first training in 2002. 225 nurses have been trained, and of those 225 nurses, 82 of them are now certified through the state SANE commission that was formed in 2004, and those SANE commission members are appointed by the Attorney General. So we have made great strides in training those professionals to perform those very important exams, and we're confident that maybe not in 2007, but very soon we will get to that 85% mark as this program continues to grow and we continue to add nurses that are trained throughout the state. And that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Very nice job, Ms. Stinson. Thank you. Questions? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Stinson, on page 9, you mentioned the intervention in regional centers and the child abuse intervention centers. In Multnomah County, is that the receiving center?
No, that is CARES Northwest.
Okay, I put down CARES or the receiving center.
Yes.
Okay. The receiving center is county then. Yes.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, a couple of follow-ups.
Certainly.
On the CAMI dollars going to the child abuse, the policy action package number 303, is there any performance measure for the MDTs? And don't get me wrong, I'm very supportive. I didn't know if there were any specific performance measures related to the CFAA dollars going to multidisciplinary teams.
Senator Brown, could you please pull the microphone a little closer?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. No one has ever asked me to
shout out. That was the first time.
Mr. Chair.
That's a problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we don't have a formal, as far as a KPM for those funds, but internally our office has instituted some common outcome measures across all of our funding sources. And I'll be happy to share those with you as they pertain to the child abuse programs. I can't recite them off the top of my head, but I know that they pertain to families feeling respected and comfortable in intervention centers and knowing that they have access to other resources. And I'm happy to share those with the committee.
Okay, thank you. And then, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, just one second. If you could please let the professional staff know not only those outcomes but any others on the performance measures that you think might advocate for your case.
Certainly.
Senator Beth.
And then, Mr. Chair, just not necessarily for you, I know that there's some district attorneys in the room. I'm just kind of curious what the victim assistance, how that's run, if there's a statewide sort of any kind of uniformity at the state level, or is it different in all the different in the 36 county offices, and how those services are provided, who provides the services, that kind of thing. So.
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, I'm happy to answer that question. There are victim assistance agencies in all 36 counties. They are in some ways very similar and in some ways very different depending on how the county structure is set up. For example, every county does receive unitary assessment funds, criminal fine and assessment account funds through our office, so they are required by statute to have a comprehensive victim services program, and in that statute there are 11 different points that they need to services they need to provide to victims. Counties provide those at different levels. Although all of them qualify under the comprehensive victim services program, there are some that are more able to deliver services fully to all victims of crime than others. For example, we have one county, I believe it's Wheeler County, where there's a 0.5 FTE person. And as you can imagine, there may not be a huge number of crimes in Wheeler County, but 0.25 FTE is not really enough to even have someone there all day answering the phone for a victim. So that they're stretched thin. In contrast, the Marion County Victims Assistance Program has, I believe, 10 staff and 63 volunteers. And so they have, a juvenile advocate, a child abuse advocate, domestic violence, sexual assault, bilingual advocates. So it really depends on how the counties are able to kind of marry the funds that they get at the state level from us and their county budgets. And depending on the part of the state that you're in, you will see different depths of services for these victims. As you can imagine, there are some parts of the state that are facing the timber issue. Those programs have the potential to be devastated because they, whatever was being put in from their general funds will not be there anymore. They'll remain with unitary assessment money.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a couple more questions if we can get through them quickly. I'd be grateful so that we can make sure we have people a chance to testify. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, and they could go by pretty quickly. One is on performance measure number 15, and I certainly understand that it will show improvement over time. I understand the reason for that number. This is not a criticism of that at all. It's just about the wording, really. I found it curious when I was looking ahead at the presentation materials. Because of the way it's worded, I was wondering, well, would you ever get to 85%, and what's in that last 15? Would there be exams conducted by someone who's not a SANE, you know, a specially trained nurse, but would that 15% include minute number where there ended up being no exam, or the exam was conducted by a doctor or some other health care provider? Will we see numbers left in because of those reasons?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, yes, there will be. The hospitals and the facilities that conduct the sexual assault exams make a choice about how they support their SANE program, if at all. And so there are some hospitals that will have doctors do those exams that may or may not be specially trained to do sexual assault forensic exams, or they may have a nurse do those exams that may or may not be specially trained. So that's why we were conservative with the 85%, actually conservatively ambitious, given the 33% we have now. But there will be, unless there's some other mandate that follows in the future, there will be a certain percentage that are done by medical professionals who are not specially trained.
Thank you. And the second question is, given that counties have differing abilities to deliver service, there are large geographic distances to cover, and sometimes it's important to get help quickly. You know, 2 or 3 month waiting period is not appropriate for certain kinds of services that need to be delivered. What is the state doing to facilitate something like interagency agreements where counties, instead of each one having only a little bit of money and not being able to do something very effectively or at all, where there's agreements for certain kinds of things to be delivered in one county and then the other county picks up some other kind of service? Do we have much of that going on yet?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, we do, in fact, have a lot of collaboration happening between the counties. For instance, with the child abuse multidisciplinary teams and the intervention centers, as you can see from the map, there's not a center in every county. Many of those multidisciplinary teams in the counties where there is not a center vote to have some of their CAMI money go to the center where they most typically send their children for exams. So they help support the center where the exams are received from their county.
I'm glad to hear it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Ms. Stinson. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Very nice job. All right. I am going to put us into a regular subcommittee of Public Safety, Ways and Means, and we are going to work session the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision Senate Bill 5531. Would the agency come forward to the desk? You won't have to give any testimony, but just in case there are any questions. And I will ask Mr. Wilson to tee it up for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, there should be a memo in front of you on your file someplace from myself to the members of the subcommittee. I will use a format similar to this for all your agencies. Some of them, like the state police, will be a much larger memo. This is one of the smaller agencies. I get told to speak up. Sorry. on the front there, you'll see a table of spending in terms of 0305 through our recommendation to you. Not needing to go through, since we just heard this, the agency mission and their primary programs and activities there are listed for your reading. The next section would be the recommended policy packages. This agency did not have any policy packages in the governor's budget, so there's no reaction to them. You will see on some budgets that there will be, at the top of the next page, budgets or packages recommended by LFO, sometimes on behalf of the co-chairs. Package 801 will appear probably later on in session for agency statewide adjustments. At this time, we'll probably take this agency and others and maybe all agencies and put into a large bill toward the end of session. But in the past, these have been used for, like, changes in the AG rate, legal rate, Secretary of State assessments, library assessments, DAS assessments that are changed for all agencies. Package 802, since this is an expedited agency, has been designated as one. They are exempt from the 2% reprioritization, so there are nothing in this package. I am recommending package 806. Just for your knowledge, 803, 804, 805 do not exist, but we've designated certain numbers for special purposes. So each analyst gets to start at 806. The others, 801 through 805, are reserved for co-chairs or statewide adjustments. So there aren't hidden packages anywhere. What I am recommending here, you did hear quite a bit of discussion around attorney general funding and those kinds of sort of shortfalls in their services and supply. I took a look at some of the other areas of their budget, and because of the switch in the board chair, the outgoing board chair was paid at a higher rate than the incoming. And I am recommending moving a little over $32,697 from personal services to services and supply. That doesn't affect the bottom of the line in the budget, but it does say that you do not need as much in personal services and that the subcommittee understands the shortages in the Attorney General and some of the other services and supplies accounts. So that is our recommendation in 806, and if you want me to go into any more detail on that, I'd be glad to.
I don't think so. Did you know that?
I did.
And in most cases, we discuss our recommendations with the agency before we present them, unless there is something we're told not to present to them. So I did have a conversation with the executive director a couple days ago about this. Those are the policy packages we're recommending. Since this is a revenue or cost-neutral policy package, just an internal switch, there is no changes or no recommended amendments to the bill itself, which should also be in front of you. We will make sure that the system, the budgeting system, picks up the package 806. And, Mr. Chair, that is sort of, there are no amendments, so we can move on to performance measures, but there will be a motion to pass this budget out at the end.
Before we go into performance measure review, does anybody have any objections to LFO's recommendations?
In terms of the performance measure, you see if you've been in other subcommittees, if you turn the page, you'll see a sheet a two-page sheet that shows the key performance measures on that first page. I am recommending no changes in the wording, but I am recommending two changes in the target for two performance measures, number 5 and 6. You'll notice that my recommendations are in bold in a larger font there on that first page. On the number 5, revocation, percentage of revocations for offenders who violate their conditions of parole and post-prison supervision. The target had been 18.3. The history in recent years is lower than that. In 2005, it was 15.4. I am recommending that target be reduced to 16%. I did talk to the agency again, and they didn't have trouble with this. It gives them something to strive for. And in 6, performance measure number 6, percentage of expiration of post-prison supervision or parole orders that have been completed and mailed within 5 days of an offender's discharge from parole or post-prison supervision, I'm recommending an increase in the targets for 2008 and 9 from 84.8, which is the current targets, to 89%. Again, in 2005, it was actually 93, almost 94%. In previous years, it was a little lower than that. But I thought the 89, given the recent history over the past 3 years or so, the 89% target would be still one they could work toward. Probably exceed, but it's a realistic one. The 84% target that was there before, or the current one, was, I thought, too low. Those are the only changes I have on this sheet. For those that haven't seen it before, the second page has our recommendation section there. This will be attached to the budget report that goes to the floor, and at the bottom of that page we'll record the subcommittee action on these performance reviews, and this will be attached to the budget report. So, Mr. Chair, that is it for performance measures.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Do we have any objections to the performance measure review suggested by Mr. Wilson and LFO? Good. Well, could then we move into motions. Would anybody like to entertain a motion on Senate Bill 5531?
Mr. Chair, I assume we're in work session?
We are.
Okay. I would move Senate Bill 5531 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means and recommend do pass.
Senator Brown?
I move the LFO recommendation.
That is not what the script says.
Oh. I have a different script.
Okay. We know that, Senator Westwood. We know that.
It's Friday.
Oh, I'm going home.
Did you hear that?
Senator Brown moves that Senate Bill 5531 go to Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? And in Ways and Means, we often don't call the roll, so since there are no objections, so moved. We will need carriers who are part of the full Ways and Means Committee to carry the Senate bill to the Senate side. You are carrying the... You've already got a duty, correct?
Let me do it a little.
Senator Weston, would you care to carry this?
These are broad shoulders, and I promise I will read the pony correctly and have Senator Brown's script. Actually, I won't need a script. It'll be okay.
We'd prefer you use it.
Yes. Then it will be Friday, and we will be going.
I will also need a carrier on the House, and that could be somebody who's not necessarily a Representative Cameron is already lined up for duty on one. Representative Parker?
Great. Sure.
Give it to Hannah. He's not here.
Excellent. Well, thank you, colleagues. Why don't we move into the public hearing section for the Department of Justice, Senate Bill 5520. Oh, and before you go, I would like to thank you very much for the responsiveness to the questions of the committee. It was very helpful in our deliberations. What we will try to do, we've got 8 people signed up. I think that should give us more than enough time if people keep their comments to, say, 4 minutes each. What I'd like to do also is to start with people who are outside of the building and to make sure that we get those who aren't professionals, advocates, to testify first, and particularly those who have come from over 100 miles to testify. Okay, good. Let us first start with Mr. Chris Brown, Douglas County Sheriff. Okay, at the same time. Mr. Berry, would you like to come up as well?
Well, thank you for your time, committee members. It's an honor to be here, and in fact, I want you to know 2 things, one of which is I volunteered to come and present this in person because this is so important to me, and number 2, I would like you to know that aside from my friendship with DOJ, I sit on the High-Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Board, the FBI's National Advisory Policy Board on Criminal Justice Information Systems, the FBI's...
Just a moment.
Could you have him introduce himself?
Oh, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Chris Brown, Douglas County.
From Douglas.
Douglas, okay.
I sit on the FBI's National Data Exchange Subject Matter Expert Committee and the FBI's Criminal Justice Information Systems Western Working Group. I say that only because... Again, aside from being a friend of DOJ, I am intimately familiar with the role they play, not only in a, on a statewide basis with anti-crime and anti-terrorism efforts, but also on a national basis. I'd like to preface my remarks by explaining that my relationship with DOJ extends for almost 20 years, and that the relationship has changed as my responsibilities have changed, and I think that probably has enlightened me the most as to the almost incredible number of venues where DOJ plays some operational or leadership role in law enforcement matters across the state. In many cases, sadly, the nature of the operational work that the Department of Justice does precludes the fanfare and public recognition that so many other entities get when they enjoy significant successes. The fact is, very few people understand the depth of work that the DOJ performs, but in the absence of DOJ, my discipline would be harmed beyond articulation. My introduction to DOJ was in the late 80s, early 90s, excuse me, when we initiated a investigation on Colombian drug traffickers with direct family ties to the Ochoa and Escobar families of the Medellin cartel. And although we had enormous resources committed to that from the FBI, from DEA, and from a myriad of other state and city and county agencies across the country, what we found was in the absence of a hub, some entity to coordinate all this information that was coming from all these different levels of government and agencies, we just couldn't function. DOJ stepped in, and I'm not sure how they did it, but they were able to coordinate that information and disseminate that information, and in many respects made that investigation occur. They also supplemented our undercover and investigative efforts. And much of this investigation involved money laundering and financial investigations, which is a resource we just don't have at the local level, and that the feds weren't able to provide us on a sustained basis. And they provided those resources. The federal agencies relied as heavily on them as we did. And their work ethic and depth of experience and portfolio of expertise and cooperative spirit so impressed me that they in many ways have served kind of as a role model in the way I pursued my career from that point forward. I'd like to tell you that during my tenure as an investigator, DOJ played vital roles in cases involving money laundering, foreign counterintelligence, domestic terrorism, criminal militia activities, organized crime, and drug cases of inordinate scope and complexity. And again, even with plentiful federal resources, DOJ was essential in assimilating the volumes of information and from a myriad of different and technologically disparate sources. Most recently, we concluded an investigation that has been ongoing for two decades, a group of traffickers who are responsible for the importation of literally hundreds, if not thousands, of tons of drugs to Oregon and then the distribution across the country, were arrested. Millions of dollars in assets will be seized. In that case, over the 20 years, the only agency that stuck with us from start to finish was Oregon DOJ. This organization eluded all the familiar federal agencies for decades, and had it not been for them, it would not have been accomplished. As you know, part of DOJ's mission is assisting local agencies with support on homicides and other high-profile, high-consequence cases. These types of cases demand special expertise and experience, and in many areas of Oregon, those abilities just don't exist, and they're beyond the capability of those communities to develop. When I mention high-consequence, I mean that failure not only means that the offenders go free, but also the public's confidence in their criminal justice agencies and system is horribly eroded. And I think everyone here can recall high-profile cases over the last few years that have been mishandled in one way or another, and the reputation of the entire criminal justice system and those agencies remains tarnished today. DOJ has a well-deserved reputation for lending a hand in those kinds of cases and demonstrating extraordinary competence and skill. And this is a service we just can't do without. Another critical asset that DOJ brings to the table is the extended tenure of its people. Most agencies rotate investigators in and out, but the people I worked with in the 80s, I work with now at Department of Justice in many cases, and that experience and institutional memory and depth ability is just a priceless resource. From the perspective of leadership in the statewide law enforcement community, you would be challenged to find an agency that contributes more with fewer resources than Oregon DOJ. Over the years, I have sat on a number of legislative advisory committees and governor's committees and ad hoc committees of various kinds and boards and so on, and I'm challenged to think of one where DOJ wasn't represented. And I would also say that because of the attributes I mentioned before, they have always offered a unique contribution in every setting, and the results would have been very, very much diminished in their absence. Through their flagship investigative support and information center, they have set a national example of what's possible when agencies share information effectively. And they, more than anyone, have cultivated a culture in Oregon where agencies from all levels of government are willing and wanting to share. DOJ has created a vision of strategic cooperation and has, through example and unwavering commitment, achieved that vision. Their reputation is characterized by things like excellence and ethics and energy and experience and leadership. And the only criticism I can muster is that I don't know how they do this with the almost embarrassingly spartan resources they have in the organized crime section and functions like that. I am intensely proud to share with you how your Oregon DOJ is perceived throughout the state of Oregon, and I cannot advocate enthusiastically enough for your continued and expanded support of them. The job they have is daunting, and everyone in my profession depends on them being there for us. So thank you for your support.
Thank you very much. Questions? Mr. Berry?
For the record, I'm Brad Berry. I'm Yamhill County District Attorney, and I'm here also on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I could say ditto and step away. Most of the notes I made were regarding particular packages that are before you, but I do need to state that I think the leadership of the Department of Justice, as well as the Attorney General himself, is not just with sheriffs and with law enforcement, but take the leadership role even for our agency. As many of you know, the DA's Association has 36 individual elected players in the criminal justice system, but we all look to the Attorney General's office and the Department of Justice for leadership, for guidance when we have the hard questions, when we can't figure things out. And that includes my colleagues who have been doing this for 20 plus years and those who may recently have been elected or appointed and never served as a district attorney before. So I would like to add that. I know you have a lot to do today, so my hope was to just bullet point some of the things that are before you related to some of the policy packages that are there. And if I might start first with the child support, the policy option package 400, and discuss that a little bit. I'm not quite sure how much information you've had related to the impact of the Federal Reduction Act to the child support, and so if in fact you're unfamiliar with that, I would be happy to take a minute to explain it. If you've had that before you, I won't take the time.
We have been briefed on it. But
great.
Feel free to tell us that.
A couple of things that I would point out about it. In the past, the state of Oregon receives what we term federal incentive payments related to our ability to collect child support and fulfill certain mandates, or I suppose in the term we use in the state performance measures, we get to certain levels. And the state then is awarded federal incentive money, which is spread between the Department of Justice, their child support program, and the district attorney's offices who have child support programs like I do in Yamhill County. There are some six, I believe, counties who do not have child support programs, but the rest of us serve a role. Generically, my office is responsible for a collection of child support for all those who request us to give them assistance who are not receiving public assistance. If they receive public assistance, then the Department of Justice is responsible for handling those cases. And you can understand that coordination on how we both work at what we do. These incentive payments come to us, and in the past we've been able to use those as leverage for other federal monies. For expenses that we spend on child support collection, for every dollar that the county pays, stating from county general fund, the federal government gives us $2, so it's leveraged 2-1. In the past, before the Federal Reduction Act, we were also allowed to use the incentive payments as part of our local match. In other words, if we got $5,000 in incentive payments, we could put it into our budgets, and the federal government would match it with an additional $10 million. And it's that change that's caused the significant problem that Policy Option Package 400 attempts to deal with, both at the state level with the Department of Justice, as well as dealing with the local level where district attorney offices are collecting child support. If you have any idea what kind of an impact these can have, the backward side of this is more troubling for me. In my county, when I'm putting my budget together and I'm short on trying to make my child support department come whole, in order for me to save a dollar of county fund if they cut us in funds, I actually have to cut $3 because it's the dollar the county has, plus I'll lose $2 in matching funds. So when we're looking at the amount of monies requested here, you have to always recognize that it's going to be 2-to-1 matched by the federal government because we roll it into our overall expenses. Coming back home now again, I have always felt that the collection of child support does several things. First, it aids in the stability of families in my community, many of which are single parents, relying on us to aid them in collection of child support. I firmly believe that stable family homes are tantamount to crime prevention. In other words, if I have a safe home where children get enough to eat, they're appropriately clothed, can get to school, I think that's crime prevention. And when I have argued in my county about the importance of the child support program, that's what I talk about. We currently, in Yamhill County, with a population of just over 90,000 people, we currently collect over $5 million a year in child support. With the small amounts of money that we have, my overall budget in the child support program for my county is about $350,000. So it is a tremendous return on investment. Now, this reduction in monies from the federal government that this attempts to address will have only a couple of options. One, we can either reduce our collection rate in how quickly we modify orders or establish original orders by cutting personnel. That's the primary one we have to look at. That has more troubling consequences than it appears on its face. First, if in fact we begin to slow the time of establishing original child support orders, or we fall behind in mandated modifications, which, and I don't do it personally, I think is every 2 years at a minimum doing modifications, then in fact we don't reach our goals that the federal government expects us to, and we further could lose incentive payments in the future. So we fall behind there, we fall behind in our share of incentive payments that are given throughout the country, and our problem in 2007-09 will get worse in 2009-11. So in sum, I just remind you in looking at this package that these funds will be leveraged 2-to-1 by the federal government. They will make up for a loss that would require all of us to look at a $3 cut for a $1 savings, and that our efforts must maintain as they are today in order to maintain our share of the incentive payments beyond that. I'm happy to entertain questions about that. I'm only going to talk about two other policy packages they have, and I'll go very quickly. I know I see you keep looking at the clock. The second I'd like to talk about is the DA Assist program that is, let me see if I can find my policy package. Policy package 250, I believe. DA Assist program is one that is critical from the local government level for dealing with prosecutions. For example, I have in my office 6 deputy district attorneys who handle felony cases, and if we get an aggravated murder case, for example, that is headed for trial, it is almost incumbent upon us to have 2 lawyers preparing that for trial and trying that case. And as you can see in my office, that would take a third of my lawyers completely out of the mix to do anything for 2 to 3 months. I will tell you that when I was first elected back in 1987, I should know that quicker than that. In 1987, we had our first significant homicide case when I was 3 months into office. There were lots of comments about, well, we haven't had a murder in a long time, and I take office and we get one. But we had co-defendants on that case. It was a particularly brutal killing, and I had nobody in my office. None of my deputies had ever tried a murder case. And my call was first to the DA Assist section saying we need some help, and they came down and helped us tremendously. And not only with that particular case, but with training to my lawyers about how to do those cases. Those are the kinds of DA Assist issues that come up all the time. Not just murders. It can be racketeering cases. We had a real estate fraud case that we called on them for assistance that had over 100 victims, dealt with racketeering and multiple defendants that we literally had never done before, and we could call up to DA Assist and get assistance on a case where we get justice because we have people who are experienced in those cases. And the DA assist is critical throughout the state, more to the offices that are medium and small than perhaps the Multnomah counties, but all of us rely on them for those particular things. One last thing I would add is they have cut services in the DA assist program. They discontinued the production of the search and seizure manual. That is a publication, and it may seem light, but that is a publication that every one of our offices use every single day. And to put just a little tiny piece of the efficiency of that, when the DA assist program creates that publication, it saves each of my lawyers, say, an hour of research to come up to the point of that publication and then go on to their particular case that they would have to renew. And that's times 36 offices throughout the state and hundreds of deputy district attorneys. It's far more useful than what might appear putting together a book that they pass out. So I wanted to point that out to you. The cooperation from that office to all of us is really of a tremendous value. The last thing I would like to talk about very briefly is the defense of criminal convictions. These are the appellate cases. None of us in our local offices handle appeals. We count on the Attorney General's office to represent the state and to ensure the convictions are maintained and that legal issues are sufficiently briefed and argued to the Court of Appeals and to the Supreme Court. When they can't be briefed and they can't be represented by this division of the Attorney General's office, one of a couple things is going to happen. One, we rely on the appellate court to somehow figure out what our argument should be, which is not going to happen. Their caseloads are huge. Or secondly, we have cases reversed that should not have been reversed. There comes even more inefficiency because those cases return to the local offices to be retried, sometimes years after those cases were first sent up to the Court of Appeals. Retried to victims of the crimes, retried where evidence may have been lost or destroyed. Between that, retried where witnesses can no longer recall what happened or can't be found. And we create a system of justice, which really is a system of injustice, when these cases are returned to us for lack of appropriate argument at the Court of Appeals and at the Supreme Court. We end up with bad law because it's not appropriately argued, or we end up with inefficiencies by sending these cases back to us. So in the sake of watching the clock for you, Chair Shields, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berry.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's see, Ms. Bennett, are you, you're not a professional lobbyist, right?
No.
Okay, please come forward. And Ms. Deborah Bridges.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I was just trying to... Not because I really want to, but because of time commitments. And I have some written testimony from a colleague. And I'll be very, very brief.
Chair Shields and committee, my name is Deborah Bridges, and I am the director of the Yamhill County Crime Victims Office. And I am so proud to be part of that office. We have a 30-year tradition of serving crime victims in Yamhill County. And I briefly want to talk to you about what crime victim advocates do. We meet victims in the aftermath of a crime, and maybe within minutes or days or weeks of this crime being committed against them. And we serve victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and homicide. With homicides, we respond to the scene right away, and we often help with death notification and support to survivors. We're hands to hold, shoulders to cry on, and literally pillars of strength for people who are facing the most difficult time of their life. We're problem solvers, and we're deliverers of hope, and we're advocates. We assist with notification of victims' rights. Basically, that's what our office is all about, is we are trying to ensure that victims of crimes, that their rights are met, that they're aware of what those rights are, that they have ways of exercising those rights. The victims of crime look to us for support in a myriad of ways. Education, the basic education about the criminal justice system. For most people, they haven't had an experience with it. So what does it mean? What do arraignments mean? What does the process of releasing a criminal defendant? How do they communicate in the court system to the judge? How do they communicate in a trial? What is their demeanor and their behavior? Some very basics to us, but for most people, they don't have that common knowledge. We assist with crime victims' compensation. It's a very tedious project for somebody to be doing when they're trying to figure out how they're going to get their child into counseling or how they're going to reunite their family when they're as a domestic violence situation. How can crime victims' compensation help them? We help victims with victim impact statements. How do we give them a voice for what has occurred to them? How do we help the judge understand the impact that this crime has had on them and on their families and on the community? Court advocacy. We help victims with courtroom tours. Like I said earlier, how does the court system run? How are they going to be a participant in it? And then briefly, Cynthia Stinson talked about all the standards that all crime victims' offices have. And Ms. Larson's testimony to you is very comprehensive and mirrors what all 36 counties attempt to do. And as counties are different, we have different resources. Ours is a small county. We have three 24/7 volunteers that respond to the scene, and we're very proud of that. That's not something that can be accomplished in all the counties. I think that our program very closely mirrors what Marion County does, although on a smaller scale. We are very, because of our small community and the resources that we have, we're able to partner with our domestic violence shelter, Henderson House, our Child Abuse Assessment Center, which is Juliet's house, and we really can work very closely together to create a web of support for victims, and we're very, very proud of that in Yamhill County. I just really wanted to be a face for you to see what victims assistance programs are. We are not prosecutors. I'm not an attorney. That's not our job. We're not law enforcement. We don't investigate crimes. We're very much a support system for victims. And if you have any questions, I'd be certainly happy to answer any of those.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Bridges? Very nice job.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry for the quick run.
And if you could please identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Bennett, and I have the opportunity to be the executive director of Liberty House, which is the Child Abuse Assessment Center that serves children in Marion and Polk counties. Are you guys hearing this okay? It sounds okay. Great. It didn't sound quite right. I think the way to sum up what I want to say in my couple of minutes is I think this is such an incredible opportunity to help the children who truly need assistance in a way that has measurable difference with a leveraging of public and private resources. I've had an incredible year as I've watched our community really respond to the incredible needs in Marion and Polk counties. I had lunch with a family who were appalled that I was staring down budget cuts this fiscal year at a time when I already have capped services so incredibly below demand that they issued a challenge to the community and said, you know what, how much do you need to balance your budget? I'm going to lay up half if you can find the other half. And our community exploded that, and we'd never raised that much money in 6 weeks before. And then I had my sights set on the next 100 kids that we need to see, and I started talking to everybody about, you know what, there's another 100 kids out there who I'm saying no to. I'm saying no to the moms and the doctors and the detectives who call us. And this incredible family walked in and listened and chatted with us and blew me away with a gift that'll help make us do that for the next 2 years. I have plenty of examples. The Shutterbug right here in Salem develops all of our film for free. We take very careful diagnostic photographs of children when we're diagnosing sexual abuse. And the Shutterbug said, I'm gonna develop those pictures for you. Hundreds of rolls a year because you shouldn't be paying for that. Let's maximize. But the thing is, I can't do that. I don't think that on the backs of those contributions, whether they're $25 or $100,000, I don't think I can do that without being able to leverage the criminal fines. I think the need is too significant, and I think that our donors, it will weigh on the donors to think that they have to pull the full brunt of that alone. Right now, the criminal fines are 34% of our budget. When we opened our doors in April of 1999, 2009, they were closer to 80% of our budget. And I think we're really working hard to leverage support, but we need those criminal fines to remain significant, I think, philosophically, as well as just to be able to do this work. Examples of kids, typical examples, not the outrageous ones who've walked through our doors. Shannon, age 12, was abused by her 24-year-old neighbor. She thought she was special because he'd chosen her for a girlfriend, and now she's 6 months pregnant. I can't get past how often we're running sexually transmitted disease tests on 10 and 11-year-olds, and we're doing it really consistently. It breaks my heart. Leanna, age 7, is the oldest of 3 children police found sleeping in a room that contained methamphetamine. There was no food in the house. Leanna explained this was because the people who came for drugs ate all of their food. Or Kendra, age 6, her bedtime for the last year has centered around the sexual abuse her father inflicts on her. She's been unable to sleep and began wetting the bed, and she says she loves her daddy but wants him to stop touching her. Over half the kids we see are under 7, and 90% of those children are there for sexual abuse concerns. 80% of those children are offended by someone who's a family member to them. These are very young children. And the amazing thing is that they can be resilient. Research will tell you there's 3 things children need to be resilient, that they're listened to, kept safe, and connected to long-term supports. And Liberty House participates in all of those things. We've also published research and replicated that research with Willamette University to show improved legal outcomes with the district attorney's office, that when children move through this approach, we see improved legal outcomes as well. And also there's research indicating that this approach saves communities money. A coordinated approach that brings children to one setting for services saves communities 26% over a non-coordinated approach. So I think this is an incredible opportunity to really leverage some money to make a difference. And my written testimony explains that we would love to be restored to the original 8.8% vision that was established in the mid-90s by the legislature and originally in Attorney General Harding Miter's budget. So thank you. I know you don't have a lot of time.
Wonderful. Thank you. Very nice testimony. Questions? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Hebb, would you be okay if we went to you later or perhaps even tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Okay.
Not tomorrow.
We'll meet tomorrow.
Oh, not tomorrow. Next week. so then I'll... Okay. Well, let's see how far we get, and then we can stick around after if we need to. Ms. Hartstein.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me. It's good to be here. Can you hear me?
You can move the microphone a little closer to your mouth.
Okay. English accent, tune in. Okay. I have supplied a paper, or actually a series of papers, to support my testimony here this afternoon. Just let me briefly run through the table of contents of that. Well, let me tell you, I'm Rachel Hardesty. I'm an assistant adjunct professor at Portland State University, where I teach restorative justice classes and death sentencing classes. I'm here to address the piece of the budget which is concerned with capital punishment. And the testimony that I've heard so far this afternoon tells me exactly where the money should be going. The first piece of the document that you have with the yellow front page is a dollar cost weighed with human toll in a provisional cost-benefit analysis of the death penalty. That's followed by a brief paper about patterns of aggravated murder sentencing that we've observed in this state since 2000. And finally is a paper I wrote a couple of years ago on the cost of the death penalty in Oregon, which is primarily about dollar cost. But also looks at just deserts of vulnerable people in this state rather than just deserts of a few people who perhaps we needn't give so much attention to. The death penalty in Oregon is not just a public opinion position, it's a policy. And when we have public policy, it should be evaluated regularly. And we should be looking at that policy and seeing whether it is in fact meeting the objectives that it claims to meet. The objectives that the death penalty is supposed to fulfill are deterrence, are public safety objectives of deterrence and incapacitation and retribution. In fact, research shows us that it doesn't meet those objectives either at all, or it doesn't meet them provenly better than alternative punishments that we have available to us. I'm willing to certainly go into that in more depth, but I know that you don't have a lot of time. There have been extensive analyses of the cost of the death penalty in this particular state. Bill Long's book, A Tortured History, A Story of Capital Punishment in Oregon, is perhaps the most exhaustive study. But we've done other studies, and we're very excited to now have the Department of Justice talk about that piece of their budget, and I really want to thank them for doing that. It's the first time that we've seen the numbers from that part of the system, and they aren't far off what we thought they were, but it's very, very interesting to see them and to listen to them being spoken about both here and this morning. I was in Portland at the Public Defenders Commission looking at capital representation and listened to Tim Sylvester talking about them also. But one of the other costs that is much less considered when we talk about the death penalty is one that isn't easily translated into dollars, and that is the cost to the human beings who have to actually implement this policy, and it's one that we rarely consider. And again, this morning I was very interested to see that judges, public defenders, as well as prosecutors were talking about the emotional cost that that the death penalty exacts from them as they are involved with it. And this is something I really want to ask you to consider, because I've begun talking with those people. Bill Long established a very clear description of the death penalty, and as a result of that, it became possible to see who the people were who actually do the work. And I began to do a listening project to talk to them about what the impact was on them. Began that project in 1999, and I began with the people who do the executions at Oregon Penitentiary. And I began talking with mainly administrative level staff about what the effect of that had been on them. And I report that quite a bit more extensively in the first paper here, including some stories that I was told about the ongoing effects and the symptoms that all the men that I spoke to still exhibit of post-traumatic stress. This morning I listened to testimony at the other meeting where public defenders went to a meeting where all of them were diagnosed also with post-traumatic stress as a result of their participation in these kinds of cases. 2 years ago, I became interested in the effect that this has on prosecutors. In the class that I teach, I often invite people from around the state who participate in our capital punishment machine to talk with my students about what that's like, what this means when we actually have a death penalty. And as a result of that, I've met a number of prosecutors, and I decided to travel around the state visiting with prosecutors in the peripheral counties. It was kind of a pragmatic decision, since I live in Portland, to go to counties where I couldn't get there in a day and back from Portland. In the 12 meetings that I had with prosecutors, I found that those people who had participated in even only a peripheral way in death penalty cases had definitely suffered from the effects of that. And those who had been more centrally involved in death penalty cases had a great deal to talk about in very thoughtful ways about the meaning of the death penalty in this state and whether it's actually delivering on the promises that it claims. One of the promises that it claims is that it delivers justice to victims in a very different way than any other kind of punishment can. I've tested that with victims' family members to talk with them about whether that's really true. In this state, we don't have very many victims' families who have people on death row. The vast majority of family members of murder victims in this state have, if the perpetrator has been apprehended at all, that person is not actually on death row. They're serving some other kind of sentence. And so the fact is that it's a very, very small number of victims' family members where the perpetrator ends up on death row. It's an even smaller number of those people where that perpetrator is executed. When we look at victims' families in this state and the effect that death penalty has on those whose perpetrators are on death row, we see that they get dragged back into appeals processes over and over and over again in an agonizing and very lengthy process. Just this last year, Dayton Leroy Rogers back in Clackamas County Court for the fourth time, and parents of some of his victims who've been the parents of a murder victim for over 20 years and have to keep returning to recreate the immediate lived experience of losing their loved one, when in fact if you look at other cases where people's cases have resolved much more quickly, you see an opportunity to heal which really isn't afforded to those people. I think probably I'll stop there. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer anything across that.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Harris. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming. Let's go to Sarah Beth and Jane Downing.
My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. What you've been handed today is a packet of information, statistics, letters from all around the state, from counselors, law enforcement, program folks. I'm actually going to have our presentation given by my coworker because, as you can hear, I have a very scratchy throat, and I didn't want you to have to listen to me. But I am here to answer any questions that you might have.
My name is Sarah Beth Labertim, and I'm an advocate with Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. I'd like to start by telling you a little bit about what our service does. We serve survivors of domestic and sexual violence here in Marion County, and we've been around for over 33 years. We provide one-on-one advocacy to tens of thousands of people every year through hotline calls and walk-in clients. That includes extensive safety planning, the address confidentiality program, and the like, and also identifying resources and helping people find what they need in the time of crisis. We also have a safe house shelter in a confidential location. We offer support groups, provide community education to thousands of people every year, helping them understand what these women and children are facing, and have an educational website that gives a lot of different resources. It's in five different languages right now and being translated into more as we have funding. And that website actually sees about 20,000 contacts a month, so we're very proud of that. What we'd like to talk to you about today is ways that our program can help ease the burden on other services in an effort to hope that you'll consider increasing funding for the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. Domestic and sexual violence has impact on many, many social services. Unfortunately, it impacts every aspect of our community. But there are three specific ways that we were thinking about that we really can help ease the burden on the other social services in this area. The first is through law enforcement. We know that domestic and sexual violence crimes make up about a third of all violent crimes in the state of Oregon. And our local Salem police chief has said that he is worried about the number of 911 calls increasing should hotline programs like ours go away. Second is with the healthcare and workforce issues. By helping women access safe shelter and get out of dangerous situations, we are able to reduce healthcare costs, hopefully reduce missed days at work and the pressures put on the workforce. There was actually statistics that showed an estimated cost of $50 million a year, which is the cost of domestic and sexual violence in Oregon, with health services, loss of productivity from work, and loss of earnings for the victims. So obviously a very large impact to our fiscal in the state. And also with education. We work closely with local schools developing age-appropriate curriculum for teachers and are also able to help with some of the youth counseling that they might not have time to deal with their budget crunch. We recently had a young boy who's in shelter who kept leaving school early every day to walk back home to shelter to make sure his mom was okay. And our youth services advocate was able to sit down with him and help him understand that mom is safe now, that he didn't have to worry about her and help him refocus back on his studies. And we've been able to work with teachers and counselors in a number of these types of situations. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions you have concerning our services and how the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund is important to us.
Questions?
Just a comment, Mr.
Senator West.
Chair. Sybil Head visited me today on this very subject, and I'm very involved with the Cobra Shelter, your counterpart, and you do noble work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice job.
Thank you.
Mr. Chris Grainer and George Oakley. Always known as George. Identify yourself and proceed.
For the record, my name is George Okulich. I'm here today representing SEIU Local 503. And next to me is Carrie DeBeck, an employee with the Department of Justice, and Chris Groner, a statewide organizer for SEIU Local 503. And we're here today. SEIU Local 503 represents approximately 850 employees in the Department of Justice, majority of whom are in the Division of Child Support. These individuals are paralegals, they're office assistants, they're investigators, and child support specialists. And we're here today simply to support the governor's recommended budget of the $5 million general backfill that was brought out to sort of make sure that the 82 positions that would be potentially cut with the Federal Deficit Reduction Act are not cut. And, you know, certainly we would are here to say, you know, these are jobs that, you know, will help people with families. And Mr. DeBeck can talk sort of more about the specifics. The one sort of caveat I would like to put on the record, and I did have a conversation with DOJ about this, is I understand there are some substantive bills coming down the pipeline that might affect this number. So right now we are supporting the $5 million backfill, but if it does look likely that there are some other things that would come up or some positions would be cut, we would like to reserve a chance to come back and ask for some additional money.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Carrie DeBeck. I live here in Salem, and as George said, I'm an employee of Department of Justice. I'm here as a member of SEIU Local 503 and I'm not speaking for the agency. I'm in support of the governor's budget where the $5 million backfills the loss under the Deficit Reduction Act. I'm aware of how the employees work and the complexity of their job, from trying to locate non-custodial parents to establishing orders for these children to get not only the cash child support for these people, but under the Deficit Reduction Act, they will also be working on trying to establish medical insurance for these children as well through the non-custodial parents, employer, or through other means. And with my 23 years with the state, I also worked in DHS. Part of those on public assistance, one of the ways that they can get off public assistance is by establishing child support orders and getting cash assistance, so that they can, through employment and a combination of employment and child support, they can get off of public assistance, become self-sufficient. So it has an impact for the welfare of the children, and it helps them, the families, become self-supporting. That's why I'm supporting the backfill of this for these positions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Groner. I'm here representing SEIU Local 503 and the members of the Department of Justice that we represent there. I'm also here supporting the $5 million backfill as well. As the statewide coordinator for the Department of Justice represented members, I see every day the workload that they have to deal with and know that they struggle daily with trying to provide the service to the citizens or the children of the state that we deserve to provide them. And this, is my understanding, would just hold us at current service levels, which isn't ideal, but I know the budget situation that we're in, so that's why I'm here to support the $5 million as well. I do applaud the agency's efforts thus far to stave off any cuts and layoffs. And I guess at this point I'd just be here to answer any questions you guys might have.
Just a quick one. That was excellent testimony, Chris, but I've got a question. Are you Ralph's son?
Can I plead the fifth, Senator?
I am.
Yeah, we were with you until then.
I am.
He's a great guy.
Frog Union, right.
And thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions?
Yeah.
Other than that, thanks. Nice job.
Thank you.
I should let Mr. Fred Boss know that we probably will get to that testimony on Monday. And if, last is Ms. Hebb, if you could please come forward.
Thank you very much. Chair Shields, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, also here on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women, which is a grassroots network of domestic violence and sexual assault advocates across the state. I'm cognizant of your time frames, and I'll be brief and just want to stress a couple of points. There's some information in the packets that were handed out to you earlier today that provided specific statistics related to the incidence and prevalence of domestic and sexual assault in Oregon and the huge number of costs that are inflicted on the state's economy by these crimes. There's also a map of fatalities that were caused by intimate partner violence in Oregon, and I want to stress, as I'm sure you're aware, but it's important to focus or to remember the fact that all of these crimes can be and are fatal, and those deaths are deaths of men, women, and children, and they're in communities across the state, and that's reflected by the red dots on the incidence prevalence map that was put together by the Department of Human Services Center for Disease and Injury Prevention. The other thing that I want to stress is that this source of funds for domestic and sexual assault is the only source of general fund dollars that go to these services across the entire state, and they were established in 2001 at $2.5 million. They've been static at that level since then. We've recently conducted, commissioned by the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice, a study that was an equity allocation study and looked at the level of need in all of the counties across the state and the way in which we were meeting that need, and found that services were drastically underfunded and that an additional $5 million is needed in that fund in order to be able to just assure basic access to minimum services. And that means hotlines on a 24-hour basis so that someone's there to answer the phone when a person is in immediate crisis and seeking to get out, shelter beds, and remember, most victims, 48% of victims leaving and seeking services, have children with them. And by far the greatest number of inhabitants in a shelter are children. So that's a huge impact that we're having on the state there, and counseling services and support and safety planning. And that's really something I also want to focus on, because there are recent studies that indicate that safety planning and access to shelter and services and support counseling do lead to a reduction in incidence and severity of further reassault. And that's groundbreaking to know, because as you may imagine, many victims are reluctant to identify themselves as victims for both safety reasons and other reasons, and it's very difficult to track people as they go through their lives and understand how our services are impacting them. We've had some recent studies that were conducted by the Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing on the East Coast by a woman named Jacqueline Campbell, who's just done a terrific job of working with survivors and tracking that information. And that's the only service that's been looked at and determined to be to lead to an actual reduction in incidence of assault and in severity of assault. So very much want to stress that these dollars that we're requesting are prevention dollars. They lead to reduced crimes, reduced burden on law enforcement, prosecution. A huge number of crimes or cases that are referred to the Department of Human Services are as a result of domestic violence. This is an issue that spreads out. We really hope that the committee will consider services and funding for these services as just a crucial part of our state's response to this critical community problem. And furthermore, just the lack of services leads to people, unfortunately, returning to violent situations. They have no other choices. It's a huge cause of homelessness. Without options, people return to a roof over their heads if they have no other choice. And we don't want to be in a position as a state of encouraging that. Last year, there were 6,500 requests for shelter nights that were denied, that could not be met. Those are people that we know of who are being who are not being served. So very much appreciate your time and the Attorney General's support of this fund and of these services. And wanted to also just briefly mention that the Division of Child Support and provision of child support services are also important to populations who are suffering from domestic violence and sexual assault. It is a benefit that helps them maintain economic viability, and want to lend that perspective to that issue as well.
Thank you, Ms. Hebb. Senator Brown.
A quick question while Ms. Hebb takes a breath. My recollection is that there is another source of funding for shelters, domestic violence victims, and that comes out of the marriage license fee. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? How much does that raise, approximately?
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, the marriage license tax raises, I believe, $650,000. I need to check on that. I don't have the current allocation. That particular provision is obviously, we're grateful for every bit we can get. That particular provision is not a significant source of funds for the programs. And
Mr. Chair? The last time the marriage license fee was raised was when?
I believe it was 25 years ago, Senator Brown, Chair Shields. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ms. Hebb, I think it would be very germane to the topic if you could help us see those outcomes. So if it's not too difficult to get your hands on that Johns Hopkins study, I'm sure the committee would love to see through the professional staff just the executive summary.
Chair Shields, absolutely.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Just briefly, I really appreciate all the work you do, Sybil, and it's really important, and I'm greatly concerned about the women who finally get the courage to call and then they are turned down if they ever get the courage to call again. That's really good to get your program. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
And just in closing, I mean, as somebody who's from Portland, a city that considers itself liberal and enlightened, in so many ways, it's really I'm ashamed at how long it takes to get a shelter bed in that city. When my work as a social worker, I saw it all the time, weeks, months, and so I appreciate the services, and we'll do the best we can for you.
Thank you very much.
Just to add, having just come off of the juvenile justice system and representing kids in the dependency system, the wait for beds with particularly mothers, frankly, with children is just, it's months. It's just abominable. So, and as Ms. Hebb appropriately noted, that really impacts our foster care system as well. So,
before we close, is there anyone else who wanted to testify that didn't have a chance to sign up on the sheets? Mr. Attorney General, would you like to respond? And we'll have more time for testimony on Monday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members Hardy Myers, Attorney General. I simply wanted to provide the subcommittee a letter from Dr. Bruce Goldberg, the Director of the Department of Human Services, in support of the Policy Option Package 350, which relates to the legal representation of the Department of Human Services in the juvenile dependency process. I would like to, if I may have that added
yes,
to your record.
Please. Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General. Anything else? This meeting's adjourned. Thank you all.